Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Daylight was fading at 9:20 p.m. on July 5th, 1919, when farmer Joseph Cowell spotted what he at first assumed was a blanket that must have fallen from a horse-drawn carriage. It wouldn't have been an unusual sight. Via Divana was an old Roman road running between Leicester and Market Harborough. The stretch was marred by divots left by countless horse hooves. The uneven terrain meant lots of things slipped off the passing traps on the regular. But as Cal drew closer to the bundle on the ground, he realized it wasn't a blanket at all. It was a person. Cowell, who'd been bringing cattle to a field near his home at Elms Farm, brought his horse to a halt and approached. He could see the form was that of a young woman who was sprawled on the ground next to her bicycle. He knelt close. The woman was wearing a straw hat that was still pinned to her hair. Underneath her head was a pool of blood on the ground. Her face was bloodied too. She was unnaturally still. Cowell hated the sight, and clearly this poor woman had fallen off her bike and hit her head something awful. She was lying diagonally, straddling the road and the grass at its edge. Both nostrils were bleeding. Cowell picked her up and moved her to the side of the road, so she was now fully on the grass. Her head lolled backwards, her body was limp, and while she was warm, he couldn't find a pulse. He staggered back, yelling, "Ye God, have mercy!" He knew he needed to get help as quickly as possible, but he was also in a bit of shock, so first he moved the bicycle from the road and leaned it against a nearby wooden gate. He also had to deal with the mass of cattle he'd been bringing home, so he led them to the closest field and rode his horse to the nearest police station. By 10:30 p.m., when Police Constable Alfred Hall reached the scene, twilight had given way to darkness. A few men huddled beside the body, illuminating it with a lantern hanging from the back of a horse-drawn milk cart. Everyone was somber. Cowell advised PC Hall that he had summoned Dr. Williams and that, yes, he had moved her body. He'd thought she'd, quote, come a cropper, end quote. That's a Britishism for had an accident, so he took her off the road to keep her safe from further harm. This was before he had realized she was dead. Hall examined the body and found it was still warm. Her limbs were flexible, meaning her death was recent enough that rigor mortis hadn't set in. Her left eyeball bulged slightly, while her right eye was mostly closed. Her straw hat, still in place, was crusted with congealed blood. Nothing in her pockets provided any indication of who she was. She only had an empty purse in one pocket and a box of matches in the other. Hall had Cowell describe in detail where the body had been when he found it, head pointing toward the middle of the road, legs on the grass. The bicycle had been lying next to her with its wheels on the road. The seat and bars were touching the grass. The men surmised she must have been headed toward Lester. It was all terribly sad, an awful reminder of the fragility of life. Here was an otherwise healthy-looking woman who had apparently simply hopped on her bike and fallen to her death. When Dr. Williams arrived, he reached largely the same conclusion with one twist. He figured she had suffered a hemorrhage that precipitated the fall, so it was likely a combination of a medical condition with a head injury that caused her death. What a tragedy, and a true pity. The men moved the anonymous woman's body to a nearby chapel. By the light of candles, Dr. Williams noted bruising on the woman's left cheek, just below the eye. It seemed curious to the policeman, but the doctor dismissed it. She would sustain that by falling, he said, adding, "I don't think we can do any more for the poor girl." It was a brief examination, and an inadequate one. The poor girl hadn't hemorrhaged and collapsed. The bruising wasn't from a fall. She had been murdered. And once someone finally looked past the blood and bruising, they uncovered a case that would push the limits of forensic science, expose deep social divides, and leave behind more than a century of unanswered questions. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Ollie. It is back to school week at our house, which means the schedule is chaos, and yet Ripley and Ellis are completely unfazed. You know why?
Why?
Because their food situation is always on point.
That's because we keep them on Ollie. It's fresh, human-grade dog food made with real ingredients. No mystery meat, no fillers, no artificial junk.
Exactly. Ripley devours the beef with sweet potatoes, and while Ellis is admittedly not very discerning, she does really love the turkey with blueberries.
And I like that Ollie customizes the meals that each dog's needs. You just fill out a quick quiz and they handle the rest.
The welcome kit makes it easy too. You get a free storage container and a guide to switch them over gradually.
And now they even offer free routine health screenings through the Ollie app, so you can keep tabs on how your pup's really doing.
Dogs deserve the best, and that means fresh, healthy food. Head to ollie.com/COTC and tell them all about your dog and use code COTC to get 60% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today.
Plus, they offer a happiness guarantee on the first box, so if you're not completely satisfied, you'll get your money back. That's OLLIE.com/COTC and enter code COTC to get 60% off your first box.
If it hadn't been for Police Constable Alfred Hall, we might know nothing about this murder today. Something about the condition of the young woman's body didn't sit right with him. Hall had served in the military. This was just after World War I, after all. And he'd seen hemorrhaging on the battlefield. Usually when someone suffered a hemorrhage, the blood gushed from the nose. But here it was merely a trickle. That meant that there should have been blood down the front of the woman's dress, but there wasn't. Her bike was nearly clean of blood, too. Just a few drops specked one of her pedals. Plus, that bruising beneath her eye didn't make much sense to him. Hall went back to the body in the morning light, but found nothing new. So he returned to the spot where she had fallen and searched the ground for hours. There were no skid marks to suggest she'd lost control and crashed, which, if Dr. Williams was right about her collapsing, might have made sense. But the scene offered little else. Hall did spot some bloodied bird tracks on a nearby fence and made note of them. By midday, authorities were alerted to a missing young woman who'd failed to return home after visiting family in the village of Galby. She'd last been seen cycling toward Lester the previous evening, accompanied by a strange man, unshaven, a little odd-looking, and riding a distinctive green bicycle. His identity remained a mystery, but now the victim had a name, Bella Wright, just 21 years old. Armed with her identity, PC Hall felt even more determined to figure out what had happened to her. He returned to the scene again and scoured the ground for another 2 hours. Finally, he found something. Inside one of the hoof-pocked divots in the middle of the road was a bullet. Here's true crime YouTuber Mark John McGuire.
Having recently returned to his post as a policeman from the trenches in France, Paul recognized it as being a .45 caliber bullet, fired by a weapon he was familiar with, a Webley Scott service revolver, which was standard army issue for officers.
Hull rushed to find Dr. Williams, imploring him to conduct another examination. Williams seemed to brush him off, saying he was busy and would stop by in the morning. Hull wasn't having it. "Tomorrow morning's no use to me," he said. "If you can't come sooner, I'll just find another doctor." Williams relented. He'd be by shortly, he said, then added a favor to hasten things. "To save time, why don't you go straight back, get some water, and wash the blood away from her face?" Hull agreed. Around 8:15 p.m., nearly 24 hours after Bella Wright's body was discovered in the road, Hull finally wiped the blood away from her face. As he cleaned, he saw it, a small hole beneath her left eye. When Williams arrived by 9 p.m., he was forced to agree. "That looks like a gunshot wound, Constable." He noted that it was about an inch beyond the lateral canthus and about a half an inch below. Then he pulled a pencil from his jacket and inserted it into the hole, tracing its path upward and backward into Bella's brain. He removed her straw hat and found the exit wound at the back of her head, about 3 inches above her right ear. It was larger than the entrance wound, roughly an inch and a half long and half an inch wide. Hull and Williams agreed. There needed to be a postmortem and an inquiry to confirm the cause and declare the manner of death. But before we talk about that, we need to understand who Bella Wright was. Her full name was Annie Bella Wright. She'd been born in July of 1897 near Melton Mowbray in rural Hallaton, Leicester. Here's Paul Brody of Well I Never.
Her father, Kenneth Wright, was an agricultural labourer, and her mother, Mary Ann, stayed home to raise Bella and her 6 younger siblings. The family lived in a small thatched cottage in the village of Stoughton, some 4 miles outside Leicester.
The family was working class, and like many girls of that background, Bella left school early, finishing at age 13, and went to work. She spent several years as a domestic servant before landing a job at Bates Rubber Works, a pneumatic tire manufacturer in St. Mary's Mills. The business was booming, and bicycles were still hugely popular, and those newfangled motor cars, fast becoming accessible to even working-class families, well, those needed tires too. Bella wasn't a particularly social woman. She was pleasant, don't get me wrong, and she did go on some shopping trips with coworkers, but she was seen as generally reserved. She got her fair share of male attention, and, it would be noted by the press later, was not a virgin when she died. Luckily, that didn't cause much of a stir among those who knew her. Bella's mother, Mary Ann, loved her daughter, but wasn't especially close with her. She knew, for example, that an army officer had been paying her some mind in the last year of her life, but she didn't know much about the guy, nor did she know if the attention he was giving Bella was welcome. On the last day of her life, Bella awoke rather late in the cottage she shared with her family, roused by the shrieks of a blackbird around 2:30 p.m. That's according to the book The Green Bicycle Mystery, The Death of Bella Wright, by author Anthony M. Brown. She had worked the night shift all the week before, and Bella liked to catch up on sleep over the weekend. This day was Saturday, July 5th, 1919, and Bella was off from work. She dressed in a pastel blue blouse and a long skirt, then chatted with her mother, who was doing laundry. Mary Ann reminded her daughter that, night shift or no, she'd better be awake in time for church on Sunday morning. Bella said, "Yes, I will, Mother." Bella sat down in the kitchen, eating toast while writing letters to some friends, as well as to her steady boyfriend, Archie Ward. The two weren't engaged yet, but everyone expected that would happen soon enough. For now, Archie was stationed on a ship moored at Portsmouth. Around 6:10 p.m., Bella was done with her letters and grabbed one from her mother, too, who wanted it mailed that day. She said she'd head to Evington to mail the whole batch and then later that night visit her cousin Margaret Evans, who was in town with a new baby at the home of Bella's Uncle George. Bella said she was excited to see Margaret's children, young Marjorie and baby James, whom she mistakenly referred to as her second cousins. Her mother corrected her. No, they're your cousins once removed. Bella said, I always get those confused. It was the last thing she'd ever say to her mother. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Beam's Dream. Look, I have to think about true crime probably more than most people, but you know what I can't stand? Thinking about true crime all night when I'm supposed to be sleeping.
Between that and my own work stress, our nights weren't exactly restful.
But then I found Beam's Dream Powder and everything changed.
That's the one you've been mixing into your nightly routine, right?
Yep, it tastes great and it's made with a blend of all natural ingredients. Reishi, magnesium, L-theanine, epigenin, and melatonin. It helps me fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up feeling actually rested.
And no next day fog, which is huge.
My focus came back and I felt like I could actually tackle the day instead of just surviving it.
And it's not just you. Beam's already improved over 17.5 million nights of sleep for people across the country.
And here's the twist. Beam's giving my listeners an exclusive offer of up to 40% off their best-selling Dream Powder. That's right, up to 40% off to finally crack the case of your bad sleep. Go to shopbeam.com/COTC and use code COTC at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/COTC and use code COTC for up to 40% off. Because better sleep, that's the kind of mystery you can solve.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Bella Wright left her family's cottage in Stoughton around 6:15 p.m., letters in hand and plans for the evening ahead. She mounted her bicycle and soon reached the junction with Shady Lane. This was a route Bella had traveled countless times before. She loved riding through the countryside, watching the various birds flitting around her. She was close to Evington when Kathleen Powers crossed her path. Powers, also atop a bike, worked at the post office, which was part of a general store and joinery business. It was precisely where Bella was headed to mail her letters. Both women greeted each other and stepped off their bicycles. Bella, I was just on my way to the store. Kathleen, what did you want? Bella, I have some letters to post. We know this exchange from later testimony. Anyway, Bella gave Kathleen a 2-shilling piece to cover the postage, handed the letters over, and watched as Kathleen put them in her satchel. The two parted ways, with Bella headed back to the family's cottage. There, she grabbed a light raincoat and spoke briefly to Philip, her 17-year-old brother. She asked if he wanted to ride with her, but he declined. That decision would surely haunt him for the rest of his life. Bella called out to her mother but got no answer and decided she'd better head to Galby before it got too late. Here's true crime YouTuber Mark John McGuire.
On her way to Galby, she had problems with her rear wheel and stopped to examine it. At this point, it seems a man appeared on a distinctive green bicycle who stopped to inquire whether he could be of assistance. She asked if he had a spanner as her rear wheel appeared to be loose.
A spanner is a Britishism for wrench.
He didn't, but offered to ride with her to her destination to ensure she got there without further problems. The two rode off together and were seen chatting as they did so by numerous witnesses.
She arrived at her uncle's house about 7:25 p.m. George Measures would later testify that his niece's arrival was a pleasant surprise. He asked some catching up questions. How's that fella you're dating? How's work? Are you excited to see your cousin? That sort of thing. Bella met her cousin Margaret's husband, Jim, and introduced herself to Marjorie, who was just 18 months old. Baby James was in a nearby crib. Margaret was having a nap. Some more pleasantries were exchanged with other family members, and while that was happening, George, a gruff guy with a peg leg, happened to look out the front window. He spotted an unshaven man wearing a gray flat cap sitting atop a green bicycle. The guy looked weird, like he was waiting for someone in George's house. A couple of carriers had arrived after Bella. These were Charles and Elizabeth Palmer, who'd come from a nearby village. So George asked them, "Hey, is that fellow with you?" Elizabeth said, "No, actually, I just saw him riding with your niece a few minutes ago." This surprised George. He knew Bella was dating Archie, and it seemed improper for her to be riding around with another man, especially one who looked as dodgy as the guy with the green bicycle. George was 61 years old and a bit old-fashioned on that front. He said goodbye to the Palmers and sat with his brow furrowed, uncomfortable about the man outside his home. After about 20 minutes, Margaret woke up from her nap. She was thrilled to see Bella, who'd been missing from her life for years. "It's been too long," she exclaimed. The two caught up over the next half an hour. Uncle George, certain that the guy on the bike would have left by now, checked the window. Nope, he was still there. This was starting to really get on his nerves. He said to Bella, "There's a man waiting outside. Is he with you?" Bella shrugged. "There's no man waiting for me, Uncle." George, "Well, there's a man out there who looks old enough to be your father. He needs a damn good shave, too. It looks like he's waiting for you. He's walking up and down. Why is he doing that?" Jim went to the window and said, "Yep, there's a guy on a bike out there." This caused Bella to shift uncomfortably. She'd met a man on a ride over, she said. He'd sidled alongside her, or in her words, overtook her on the road. He said he was from Great Glen.
She told Mr. Measures that the man was a perfect stranger and said, "Perhaps if I wait a while, he will be gone." Though appearing not to know the man, Bella did not seem frightened and did not ask her uncle to make him leave.
Uncle George chastised her a bit. She knew better than to talk to some strange man. At 8:35 p.m., so more than an hour after arriving, Bella said she was ready to leave. Uncle George and cousin-in-law Jim checked the window, and it seemed the scruffy man had given up. He was nowhere to be found. Bella seemed relieved. Jim had remembered that when she first arrived, she mentioned she was having trouble with her bike, so he took a look at it. The rear wheel was loose, so he grabbed a wrench to tighten it. A few minutes later, Bella got ready to leave when a squeaky voice called out, "You have been a long time. I thought you had gone the other way." It was the unshaven man. Later, George and Jim would both swear that they heard the man call Bella by her name. Bella seemed to be blushing. Jim broke the tension by making small talk about the man's bicycle. "That's an unusual color," he said. The man agreed. It was pea green, he explained, in what Jim thought was a Cockney accent. With the man's blessing, Jim examined the bike, making observations that would come in handy later. It had 3-speed gears, was a BSA Cycles brand, and had a back-pedaling brake, a rarity for the time. As the men talked, Margaret asked Bella in a hushed voice, "Are you sure you don't know him?" Bella insisted that no, he was a stranger. He joined her on the ride over, and she expected he'd be gone by now. But Margaret wasn't convinced. The man seemed awfully familiar, and Bella didn't seem nearly spooked enough for them to truly be strangers to each other. Uncle George was making observations of his own. He noted the man was about 5'6". He had short brown hair flecked with gray. His dark eyes were too close and his eyebrows too bushy. He had a thin upper lip, soft jaw, sallow complexion, and pointed nose. Uncle George didn't like the looks of him one bit. It didn't help that he clearly hadn't shaven in days and was wearing a shabby gray suit. Things got awkward with the man clearly waiting on Bella and Bella clearly wanting to get home before nightfall. She quietly assured her family she'd lose this guy on the road. At 8:45 p.m., she hugged her goodbyes and promised to hurry home. The man with a green bicycle walked alongside her, until the two disappeared over the horizon. The family left behind felt uncomfortable with the whole situation. Margaret and Jim Evans felt certain that Bella must have known this guy before tonight. Regardless, they trusted she would get home safe. Of course, this was the last time anyone in her family ever saw her alive. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hungry Root. When it comes to grocery shopping and meal planning, I've got this problem. Every August, we're scrambling to get back into a routine with Hunt starting school and this time me heading back to teach. Figuring out dinner just adds to the chaos. That all changed thanks to Hungry Root. It's like having a personal shopper and nutritionist in one. They fill our cart with healthy groceries and quick recipes tailored to what we actually like.
And you've been using those little recipe cards to pair things up, right?
Yeah, the box we got had boiled eggs, quinoa, peanut butter, low-sugar candies, and even better-for-you chips. Most recipes take 15 minutes or less, which is perfect on busy school nights.
And the kids' snack section? Hunt's been really into those. It makes packing lunches way easy.
Exactly. No artificial junk, no high fructose corn syrup, just good stuff that fits into our routine and saves me so much time.
You're going to love Hungry Root as much as I do. Take advantage of this exclusive offer. For a limited time, get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. Go to hungryroot.com/COTC. Use code COTC.
That's hungryroot.com/COTC, code COTC, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. hungryroot.com/COTC, code COTC.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Bella Wright and the man on the green bicycle were spotted several more times after they left her uncle's house in Galby. The sun was low in the sky, the shadows stretching long across the hedgerows. The pair headed southeast out of Galby, with Bella pedaling just ahead. According to those who saw them, the man was never far behind her. One man saw them around 8:50 p.m. riding toward King's Norton. The witness was standing near a field gate as they passed. While he didn't get a good look at their faces, he remembered them later because of the unusual color of the man's bike. You just didn't see pea-green bicycles very often. If it hadn't been for that detail, the memory might not have stuck, as nothing else seemed out of the ordinary. If you'll remember, Bella's body was discovered at 9:20 p.m. Around that same time, maybe a few minutes prior, a couple saw a man on a green bicycle on the road between Stretton Parva and Great Glen. This was Alfred Johnson, a tenant farmer, and his fiancée, May Walker. It's worth noting, too, that the scruffy man might have been spotted well before Bella's death riding his bicycle alone as well. Two schoolgirls, Muriel Nunney, age 14, and Valeria Caven, age 12, said they were birdwatching near some farmland when a man approached. Unshaven, in a light-colored suit, raincoat slung over his shoulder. He came too close for comfort and, in a squeaky voice, asked what they were doing. Then he suggested a game. Follow the leader. He told Val to stay put and Muriel to cycle on with him. The girls were creeped out and rode off. He didn't follow. Now, none of this would be known for a long time. First, farmer Joseph Cowell would find Bella's body, and then, a full 24 hours later, it would be determined that her death hadn't been the accident he initially assumed. While Cowell was still convinced it had been a tragic fall, Bella's mother, Mary Ann, was growing increasingly uneasy. Bella was an adult, sure, but her mother was protective of her, and Bella wasn't the type to arrive home late. Like I said before, she wasn't much of a social butterfly, and she always made a point to go to bed at a decent time Saturday so that waking up for Sunday church wasn't a slog. Marianne went to bed feeling something was very wrong. When she awoke Sunday and Bella still wasn't home, she was in a panic. Communicating with police in this era wasn't as easy as it is today, so she reported her daughter missing at the post office at Evington. The details were telegrammed from there to the police. Had Police Constable Alfred Hall been there at the time, he likely would have put two and two together and realized the woman he had found dead Saturday night was one and the same, but it would be hours before he would learn this information as he was already back at the scene of Bella's death, searching for clues. It wouldn't be until July 7th, more than 36 hours after Bella's death, that her mother would have to do something no parent should ever face. She identified the body of her daughter. Dr. Williams was assisted by Dr. Phillips in performing the postmortem. The next morning, so on Monday, Superintendent Herbert Taylor visited the death scene and spotted the bird prints left in blood that Hall had noted earlier. But Taylor also found something else, a dead crow in the nearby cornfield. Its feet were covered in blood and matched the tracks left on the fence. It was clear the bird had hopped through Bella's blood after her death, an assumption supported by an examination of the crow, which showed its crop was full of fresh blood. It had apparently choked to death on it. The first news stories about Bella's death didn't convey that she had died of a gunshot wound, but rather appeared under the generic headline, Woman Cyclist Death. In the story, she was nameless and thought to have had a seizure, prompting her to fall from the bike. It wasn't clear whether it was the fall or the seizure that had killed her, the story said. Yet at the same time, police were printing handbills, small posters that would be widely circulated to all police forces across Britain.
The police issued a poster seeking information and offering a £5 reward for the discovery of the man riding the distinctive green bicycle. A description of him was also given. He was between 35 and 40 years of age, approximately 5 feet 7 inches tall, and he was wearing a grey suit with a collar and tie and a flat cap.
It also detailed that Bella had been shot through the head. From the wording of the handbill, there was no question that the man with the green bicycle was the prime suspect in what appeared to be a murder. On Tuesday, the coroner, Edmund Buskell, opened an inquest into Bella's death. The first day, there were just two witnesses, Marianne Wright, who confirmed the identity of her daughter, and Joseph Cowell, who described how he had been
herding his cows along the road between pastures and saw a lump in the Gartree Road at Little Stretton. By now the sun was setting, and it wasn't until he was close to the lump that he realized it was a figure lying on the road beside a bicycle.
He confirmed the figure was indeed the same woman now on display at the inquest. With that formality out of the way, Bella's remains were released to her family for burial. The newspaper's coverage of the death immediately shifted, with headlines reading things like, Stretton Murder Mystery. A newspaper called the Mercury wrote that Bella was, quote, foully done to death on her way home after a spin around Evington, end quote. It added that police were searching for a man who'd been riding with her and was considered a suspect. Police, however, weren't being so forward about things, at least not with the media. They said they just wanted to interview the man for information. Someone who read the Mercury story was a bicycle repairman named Harry Cox, who reported he had repaired a bicycle just like the one described a week before Bella's death. There'd been a problem with the three-speed gear control, which should have been an easy enough fix, but Cox had accidentally broken the control cable, and so he needed to order a new one. Long story short, the customer had come back July 5th, paid 4 shillings and 9 pence to Cox for the work, and went on his way. Everything about the man Cox described matched what George Measures and Margaret and Jim Evans had told police, right down to the squeaky voice with a Cockney accent. But hopes were quickly dashed when Cox said he had never asked the man's name and didn't know where he lived. Here's what Cox did tell police, as relayed by McGuire.
I had half an hour's talk with him. and he said he was staying with friends in Leicestershire. He said he was a demobilised officer and working in London. He said the firm had told him he could have another 2 or 3 weeks' holiday on full pay as they were not busy.
Thousands of people attended Bella Wright's burial July 11th. She wasn't a well-known figure in town, but the story of her death touched so many. It was so senseless and brutal and seemingly random. Mourners crammed the church pews while hundreds who couldn't fit inside stood outside to hear the vicar's sermon through open doors. Police officers were scattered among the bereaved and looky-loos alike, eyes peeled for anyone matching the description of the man with the green bicycle. They ended the day disappointed. Police naturally questioned Archie Ward, Bella's not-quite-fiancé. His alibi was solid, and he offered no insight about the man with the bicycle. He did mention Bella had an ex-boyfriend who had boasted he'd slept with her, which was a bit of a scandal at the time. Police tracked down the ex, however, and ruled him out. Frustrated with their lack of progress, police published a second handbill that offered a £20 reward for information leading to the identification of the man. At the time, rent for a modest working-class home cost between 5 and 7 shillings, so £20 would have likely paid well over a year's rent. This handbill also classified the death as murder. That might seem like a no-duh situation, but homicides aren't automatically murders. There's justifiable homicide, there's self-defense. Murder is a legal classification, and declaring it prematurely can be risky. If the man with the green bicycle saw that police were already calling this a murder, it might have put him on edge. The inquest picked back up on Friday, July 25th, and stretched across several days over the following weeks. Key witnesses included Dr. Williams, who initially examined Bella, and Dr. E. Phillips, who had helped conduct the second examination. That's the official postmortem. Then there was Uncle George, Cousin Margaret, and cousin-in-law Jim. P.C. Hall testified, of course, while Chief Constable Edward Holmes kept the media apprised. Holmes repeatedly urged the public to come forward with any information about the man with the green bicycle. On August 8, 1919, the death was officially declared willful murder by person or persons unknown. And then the case went cold. You know how every few months someone pops up with aliens built the pyramids?
Or aliens love gold and abduct people because reasons?
Exactly. Well, there's a podcast that tackles all that nonsense head on and is part of our Grab Bag collab family. It's called More Like Ancient Aliens.
This is hosted by journalist Brandon R. Reynolds and podcaster slash author Toby Ball. And they dive into the History Channel show Ancient Aliens one episode at a time.
Yeah, that show's a meme maker. And it's been running for some 21 season and 200 episodes insisting aliens did it. Brandon and Toby break down those big claims from the Big Bang to Atlantis, from the Old West to Area 51, sifting the truth from the nonsense.
And they've got amazing guests, too. Comedian Dana Gould, true crime queen Maggie Freeling, comedian and voice actor Janet Varney, and soon the brilliant humorist John Hodgman.
Plus, I even pop up in an episode or two because I want to pretend that I belong with that crew.
The best part is you can now listen to it everywhere, not just through Grab Bag Collab's Patreon.
So search for More Like Ancient Aliens wherever you listen to your favorite podcast and let Brandon and Toby abduct you into the fun while they uncover what's really going on out there.
I'm subscribing right now.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Despite the substantial reward offered for information, the man with the green bicycle had vanished. Weeks passed, leads dried up. The newspapers moved on. And then, almost by accident, the case sprang back to life. Enoch Whitehouse worked as a canal haulier. That meant he loaded cargo, think coal, grain, textiles, and such, onto a long, narrow boat and delivered it along the inland waterways. On Monday, February 23, 1920, his route took him down the River Soar, which winds through Leicester. As it happened, he was delivering cargo to St. Mary's Mills, the factory complex where Bella had worked, when one of his tow ropes went slack and slipped into the water, as author Anthony M. Brown described in his book. About a minute later, the rope pulled taut again. When Whitehouse hauled it in, he saw what looked at first to be scrap metal. But as the river muck washed away, it revealed the frame of a bicycle. And not just any bicycle. It was a green bicycle. Everyone in town had been whispering about the mysterious green bicycle for months, and now here it was, or at least part of it. The rear wheel was missing, along with several other components. Whitehouse made note of the location and returned the next day to search for more pieces. The back wheel still didn't turn up, but enough of the frame remained to ignite public interest all over again. Plus, the Evington Echo later reported that Whitehouse also found a holster sized for a .45 caliber service weapon, as well as ammunition consistent with the bullet found by P.C. Hall in the road. The bike, as suspected, was a BSA. Investigators searched the enameled frame beneath the saddle for a serial number, but their hopes sank. Someone had filed it off. Police turned to William Saunders, a local BSA agent, to ask whether there was any other way to trace the bike's origin. Saunders said, well, there might be. If it had been a special order, a second serial number should be hidden somewhere else. Sure enough, Saunders took the frame apart and found tiny numbers stamped on the inside of a tube. Using a magnifying glass, he found a second, barely visible serial number. BSA traced that to order number 103648, placed nearly a decade earlier, on May 3, 1910, by a Derby dealer called Orton Brothers. And unbelievably, the Orton Brothers still had the paperwork. The buyer was Ronald Light. Within days, police were at Dean Close School in Chetenham, where Light worked as a tutor. Ronald Light didn't make a scene when police showed up at his school in early March 1920. He was calm and generally polite. When asked whether he owned a green BSA bicycle, he at first said no. Detective Superintendent Herbert Taylor pressed. Oh, really? You didn't buy a BSA bicycle from Orton Brothers in Derby? Light backtracked, saying, oh, right, I did buy one a long time ago, but I'd forgotten all about it because I sold it a year later. Bummer, though, I can't remember the buyer's name. Asked where he had been on the night of July 5th, 1919, around 9 p.m., Light said he had no idea. I mean, maybe at home with my mother? He'd never heard of Galby, he said. Taylor wasn't buying it. He brought Light to the Cheltenham police station, where bicycle repairman Harry Cox was waiting. Cox picked Light out of a lineup instantly. I mean, by then, it was undeniable. The bike had been his. George Measures and Jim Evans also ID'd him as the man who had ridden with Bella. And the deeper police dug, the more troubling Light's past became.
It seems he was expelled from his private school at the age of 17 for lifting a young girl's skirt above her head. He had graduated from Birmingham University and then commenced an engineering apprenticeship for the Midland Railway in Derby. Although well-liked, he was dismissed for setting fire to a store and drawing obscene graffiti on the toilet walls.
He was also caught forging telegrams to delay a military deployment. A pattern was emerging, not of violence necessarily, but of dishonesty and evasiveness. As his trial neared, Light switched tacks. He finally admitted to riding with Bella, but he insisted they had only ridden a short while and she was quite alive when they parted ways. He had nothing to do with her death, he said. As for the dismembered bicycle, well, he said he had tossed it after reading the police flyers, essentially calling him a murderer straight away. He didn't ditch it because he was guilty, he said, but because he feared being wrongly accused. It wasn't a great look. On March 5th, 1920, Ronald Light was officially charged with the murder of Bella Wright. His trial began June 8th, 1920, at Leicester Castle. The courtroom was packed, reporters, spectators, and a jury asked to decide whether this squeaky-voiced schoolteacher was, in fact, a killer. The prosecution was led by none other than the Attorney General himself, Sir Gordon Hewart, a man known for his sharp tongue and commanding presence. From the start, Hewart made it clear, this wasn't a case about motive, but about guilt hiding in plain sight. Light had admitted he'd been with Bella Wright that night. He had lied to police. He'd hidden the green bicycle, breaking it down, scraping off its serial number, and dumping it in the River Soar. And when confronted, he claimed he'd only panicked after seeing his description in the newspaper. While there's no official transcript of the trial, news coverage of the time indicates that Hewart asked the jury something akin to, if Light were innocent, why would he not step forward to help the investigation? Why would he have tried to destroy evidence and go to such lengths to vanish? Witnesses took the stand one after another, painting a picture of a man who was, at best, deeply peculiar, and at worst, hiding something sinister. Bella's uncle and cousin described the odd man who had waited outside their home for more than an hour, clearly expecting Bella to leave with him, while Bella seemed determined to shake him. Harry Cox confirmed he'd repaired the same green BSA just before Bella's murder and identified Light as the customer. Even Light's own admissions under questioning seemed to hurt him. He admitted to concealing the bike and throwing his service revolver and ammunition into the canal. Also, a ballistics expert called by the prosecution testified that the bullet recovered near Bella's body could indeed have come from a standard-issue service revolver like the one Light had owned. It was one of the earliest uses of ballistics evidence in a British courtroom. Because Light came from money, his family was able to afford a courtroom legend sometimes called the Great Defender. Sir Edward Marshall Hall knew how to spin a story, and more importantly, how to cast doubt like a spell. Marshall Hall argued that this was a case built on shadows. There were no eyewitnesses to the killing. No definitive murder weapon had ever been found. And that bullet discovered on the road in the vicinity of Bella's body? Marshall Hall was a firearms enthusiast who knew two things. One, that because of the war, that type of ammunition was seemingly everywhere at the time. And two, the trajectory of the shot shouldn't have left the bullet where it was found on the ground. He convincingly argued that there was no way the bullet could have landed in the spot where PC Hall found it. As for the destroyed bicycle, he said Light had made foolish decisions in the midst of a panic. He warned the jury not to confuse fear with guilt. And then, Marshall Hall offered the jury an alternative. What if Bella had been shot accidentally, perhaps by a farmhand hunting crows? You remember that dead crow police discovered? The one with the crop full of fresh blood? The area was rural, unlit, and unpoliced. Couldn't a stray bullet from far off have struck her just as she cycled past? In court, possible can be enough. The judge's instructions were clear. The burden was on the Crown. The evidence had to be beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury retired to deliberate. They returned in just over 3 hours. On June 11th, 1920, the verdict was read aloud. Not guilty. Just like that, Ronald Light was a free man. But he was never cleared of suspicion. While some people applauded the jury for not convicting when the direct evidence was lacking, others found the acquittal an outrage. Had Ronald Light not been from a wealthy family, they said, he surely would have been convicted. The circumstantial evidence was strong. He'd lied repeatedly during the investigation, which prosecutors to this day consider evidence of guilt. So which was it? Was a wrongful conviction thwarted, or had Ronald Light gotten away with murder? It's a mystery that remains to this day. Though there is a twist. Days after the jury reached its verdict in the case, Superintendent Bowley apparently typed up a record detailing a conversation he said he had with Light, during which Light confessed. The document was kept for decades in a police safe, but it was published for the first time in Anthony M. Brown's 2017 book. Bowley couldn't do much with the confession because of double jeopardy, and while there's some corroborating documents that suggest he might have been weighing a perjury charge based on what Light told him, Bowley never moved forward with it. So here's what the document states. It says that Light came to pick up the belongings police had confiscated during his arrest. Bowley and Light exchanged pleasantries, with Bowley congratulating him on evading the gallows. He even said that he was the only officer who thought Light was innocent. But he said, you know, if you have anything to get off your chest, I'd be happy to listen. It took a bit of cajoling, but eventually, Light said he shot Bella. But it had been an accident. He said he'd been discussing his time in France and offered to show her his service revolver. Thinking it was unloaded, he handed it over, then it fired. He couldn't explain why the revolver went off. He said it happened quickly. Quote, she fell over and never stirred. I knew she was dead, end quote. He did not think that the bullet that PC Hall found came from his gun. He said the bullet would have gone much farther and wasn't angled to strike the ground. It likely got stuck in a tree somewhere, he said. He also claimed he had never met Bella before the day of her death, which is noteworthy because both Bella's mother and a friend had reportedly said Bella had mentioned a military man kind of hanging around in the weeks leading up to her death. Some have speculated that Light could have been this man and that Bella may have known him at least in passing. His claim of a first-time meeting undercuts that, but whether he's being honest or trying to minimize the appearance of a deeper connection is anyone's guess. Anyway, after the search for him was underway, Light said he decided to ditch the bike, though it was a few months later, not immediately, like everyone assumed, and he ditched the revolver. He also said he threw another gun into the river as well. And this was noteworthy because one thing that hadn't sat right with witnesses was that the bullet hole in Bella's head appeared to have come from a smaller caliber gun than a service revolver.
With both Ronald Light and the officer who wrote the notes long dead, there is no way to know if it is authentic. And the mystery of the green bicycle lives on.
For years, there had been whispers of a confession, but it wasn't until the past decade that a physical document surfaced to back up the rumor. The type statement, allegedly dictated by Light himself, was found in old police files and included Bowley's signature. Now, some skeptics have questioned its authenticity, suggesting it might be a forgery. But Arthur Brown, who brought the document to Light, hired an expert to analyze its legitimacy. The verdict? Everything looked legit. I mean, the typewriting, the paper stock, even the watermark on the paper itself. But let's go back to that bullet. It's the detail that floors me. The very bullet that led police to realize Bella had been shot may not have been the one that killed her. PC Hall didn't look for foul play until he found that slug lying on the ground. But if it wasn't from the fatal shot, if it was just a stray round from some other source, then what seemed like hard evidence might have been a fortuitous red herring. And that's part of why the green bicycle mystery still lingers. Not just because it's unsolved, but because so many pivotal moments hinged on luck. A stray bullet uncovering Bella's cause of death, a tow rope snagging a bike frame, a serial number missed by its owner but spotted by chance, a repairman's sharp memory, a confession that came too late to prosecute. This isn't just the story of a young woman cut down on an ordinary evening. It's a story of near misses, overlooked truths, and how, even a century later, the line between justice and mystery can hang by a thread. To research this case, I read Anthony M. Brown's The Green Bicycle Mystery, The Death of Bella Wright, part of a series called Cold Case Jury True Crime Collection. There weren't many reliable audio sources to help tell the tale, and some details have been muddled in the intervening century, so I only use portions of Paul Brody's While I Never and Mark John McGuire's They Got Away with Murder when I could match them to McGuire's book, which relied heavily on contemporary news coverage. Brown also drew on H. Russell Wakefield's The Green Bicycle Case, The Trial of Ronald Light for Murder of 1930, a nonfiction account that helped fill in the courtroom and evidentiary details. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Lowe's knows tough jobs call for tougher tools. The new DeWalt Elite Series power tool accessories are built to last for the pro who doesn't stop. With precision fitment, durability, and impact resistance, finishing jobs faster has never been easier. Shop the new DeWalt Elite Series at an everyday low price, exclusively at Lowe's. We help, you save. Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.